Good morning. Good to see you all. Continuing our series in Deuteronomy today called Choose, we're looking at the sermons that Moses gave to the children of Israel as they were about to go and inherit the promised land. And it was Moses' desire in these messages to remind them of all that he had taught them as they wandered in the desert in hopes that they would not repeat the mistakes of their forefathers, but also so they would not repeat the mistakes that they themselves had made. Now, as we've looked over these messages, we've focused primarily on the issue of making decisions. How do we make good choices? In our lesson today, we're going to be looking at what God says about the poor. And in it, we're going to address much of society's response toward the poor in contrast to what God says about the poor and how we decide what to do and what not to do. I have to say that reading these texts afresh was very eye-opening. I hope that you find them that way as well. When we consider how much of what passes as wisdom and judgment is actually very out of step with the teachings of the Bible. So let's take a look today. Deuteronomy chapter 15. I'm going to be reading from the English Standard Version. Please follow along in whatever translation you have. The one in your lap is always my favorite. Remember, if you're using an electronic device, if you turn that to silent, please, for the comfort of those around you. Deuteronomy chapter 15, beginning in verse 1. And at the end of every 7 years, you shall grant a release. And this is the manner of the release. Every creditor shall release what he has lent to his neighbor. He shall not exact it of his neighbor, his brother, because the Lord's release has been proclaimed. Of a foreigner you may exact it, but whatever of yours is with your brother, your hand shall release. But there shall be no poor among you, for the Lord will bless you in the land that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance to possess, if only you will strictly obey the voice of the Lord your God, being careful to do all of this commandment that I have commanded you today. For the Lord your God will bless you as he has promised you, and he shall lend, and you shall lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow, and you shall rule over many nations, but they shall not rule over you. If among you one of your brothers should become poor in any of your towns within your land that the Lord your God is giving you, you shall not harden your hearts or shut your hand against your poor brother, but you shall open your hand to him and lend to him sufficient for his need, whatever it may be. Take care lest there be any unworthy thought in your heart, and you say, the seventh year, the year of release, is near, and in your eye look begrudgingly on your poor brother, and give him nothing, and he cry out to the Lord against you, and you be guilty of sin. You shall give to him freely, and your heart shall not be grudging when you give to him, because the Lord your God will bless you in all of your work and in all that you undertake, for there will never cease to be poor in the land. Therefore, I command you, you shall open wide your hand to your brother, to the needy, and to the poor in your land. And if your brother, a Hebrew man or Hebrew woman, is sold to you, he shall serve you 6 years, and in the seventh year you shall let him go free. And when you let him go from you, you shall not let him go empty-handed. You shall furnish him liberally out of your stock, out of your flock, of your threshing floor, and out of your winepress. And as the Lord your God has blessed you, you shall give to him. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you. Therefore, I command you this day. But if he says to you, I will not go out from you because he loves you and your household, since he is well off with you, well, then you will take an awl and put it through his ear into the door, and he shall be a slave forever. And to your female slave you shall do the same, and it shall not seem hard to you when you let him go free from you. For at half the cost of a hired worker, he has served you 6 years. So the Lord your God will bless you in all that you do. All the firstborn males that are born of your herd and your flock, you shall dedicate to the Lord your God. And you shall not do work with your firstborn of your herd. You shall not shear the firstborn of your flock. You shall eat it, and you and your household before the Lord your God, year by year, at the place that the Lord will choose. But if he has any blemish, if it is lame or if it is blind or has any serious blemish, whatever, you shall not sacrifice it to the Lord your God. You shall eat it within your own towns. The clean and the unclean alike you may eat of it, as though they were the gazelle or a deer. Only you shall not eat of its blood. You shall pour it on the ground like water. Blessed be the reading of God's holy word. Those words are mesmerizing. There shall be no poor among you. Now, for many of us, as we read something like that, I mean, we can't help but think a little bit maybe like a beauty queen contest in the interviews. And at the end, the common response is that people want to end poverty and create world peace, all of which we think of as being totally unrealistic, but a nice sentiment, a nice platitude to say at the end of such a thing. But this isn't a beauty contest. It's not platitudes. It's not nice ideas. It's Almighty God speaking to Israel about how to govern their land. As they're getting ready to take possession of the promised land, as he's talking to them about what it means to continually inherit this land and to do so justly and for God to bless them. And in that, he says, there'll be no poor among you. Now, at the same time, he also says that the poor will always be there in the land. And in that, we could seemingly see a contradiction. And it might be tempting on our part at that moment to just try to explain that away, to kind of make it go away. And we begin to explain it in such a way that we really allude to the idea that there is a contradiction that we don't understand. And so then people that are listening to us begin to think, well, gosh, the Bible's so full of contradictions, even the Christians can't understand it and things like that. But here's the thing is that there's the stated goal of God. That there shall be no poor among you. And yet he tells us about the problem of sin in our hearts that keeps us from eradicating poverty. And he puts the blame of poverty squarely on a fallen world and hard hearts. Now, you know, Jesus quoted this passage in the New Testament, Matthew chapter 22, when he was just shortly before he died, and they were gathered together in an upper room, and they were honoring him in the Passover meal. And one of the women came, and she brought an alabaster box that was full of nard, a perfume, a very expensive perfume. And she broke that open, and she began to anoint his feet and to worship him, to give him praise for what he had done because of her many sins that had been forgiven. And in that moment, Judas, you remember Judas, the one that betrayed Jesus, the one who sold him for 13 pieces of silver, the one who, it says in the text, was the guy who... Well, he was the keeper of the till. He was the keeper of the box. And so he goes into this instant fake outrage. You know that instant fake kind of religious outrage? Whenever we grab something religious and we twist it, you know, kind of like Satan grabs Scripture and he twists it to use it for his own ends, which has nothing to do with the righteousness of the moment. It has nothing to do with what's good or right, but it's used to justify. It's kind of a CYA kind of moment where we grab a Scripture and then we feign outrage. And Judas feigns outrage and he says, well, that could have been sold and the money could have been given to the poor. Right. And then it also tells us that he was commonly helping himself to what was in there. So that, you know, because of course, poor Judas, you're right. I mean, you know, he needed what was in the bag. He feigns outrage. And one of the things that is intriguing to me is how many times I've heard people take that same passage out of context and justify not helping the poor with the kind of, you know, well, the poor you will always have with you. And when I think about things like that, it bothers me greatly that we would twist words, especially words in the Bible, which is what Satan was famous for, Hitler too, to avoid doing what is good and what is right. I've heard people use those things sometimes to twist them so much so and trying to convince me. And I can just tell you that when you come to places where you know you're twisting Scripture, just keep in mind that God knows your heart. And if that doesn't bring you comfort, then you probably ought to stop doing it. That's one's for free. But the heart of God is, in this passage, he says to them, as they're getting ready to take hold of this land, this good land that is dripping with milk and honey, this land that is full of blessing, he says to you, as you go in and you take hold of this great land, that there should be no poor among you. But there's also the realities of poverty. One is that well, God's people don't always do what is right. And I don't mean just doing what is right in the sense of the rescue part, but I also mean the part of just sin causes a lot of problems for us, doesn't it? And many times it causes us to reap things that we sow, and there's fallout from those decisions in life. I mean, that is, after all, why we seek forgiveness and a relationship with Jesus Christ, because we understand that we often make decisions in life that are not good decisions, and then we reap the repercussions of those things, and we cry out to God for His mercy. We don't want His justice in that moment. We want His mercy in our lives. We want His forgiveness. We want Him to cover our sins. Isn't it good not to always get what you deserve? The second is in this whole thing is that in financial distress is that, you know, people make poor life choices. And so sometimes just the repercussions of those things do affect us in this world. But always God is pointing to the fact that it is incumbent upon us when we see poverty in the world to never let it harden our hearts toward those in poverty, because that too is sin, when we harden our hearts toward them. Because in the same way that we need to be forgiven of our sin and our poor life choices, so does everyone else. It's always easy to find, you know, mercy for me, but justice for everyone else. It's not hard for us to be able to claim mercy and realize that we do not deserve it. It's another thing when it affects us and it's someone else who's in need of the forgiveness or whose life choices have negatively impacted us. As we look through here in the Old Testament, one of the things that's intriguing to me, you know, I'm always hearing from people about how harsh the Old Testament was, and I don't agree with that reading at all. I think that that is from reading from kind of a Greek mythological standpoint. I think that's reading Roman and Greek ideas, pagan ideas into the Bible whenever you read it that way. I think that the reason that people read it that way is because we're oftentimes much more influenced by pagan theology rather than Christian theology. The laws of the Old Testament are full of great protections. And one of the places where there are wonderful protections, unparalleled, even in our modern justice system, is with regard to the poor. Like the forgiveness of debt after 7 years. Who does that? Who does that? I want to sign up for that credit card, don't you? Yeah, no. Nobody does that. Nobody does that. It's not the way things function. In fact, here's the reality. I don't care where you fall on this spectrum politically, but even, you know, a few years ago, as we were considering whether or not to establish relationships with Cuba again, and some of the issues that were on the table, that were multied and varied, but can I just tell you that one of the issues was that there was debts that were owed to us from 50 years ago. And one of the biggest motivators for why we kept those things in place was actually because of holding on to those debts. Who does that? Who forgives debt after 7 years? I know of no one who does that. The closest thing that I know of to anything like that is in our laws. It's actually based on these laws in the Old Testament, was the idea that after 7 years, we would remove a bankruptcy after a person's credit report. Eventually, those things fall off the credit report. After 7 years, we stop keeping track of them. That is actually where the admonition, that's where the idea came from, was from the biblical text. I bet you didn't even know that. But even then, often the people who most need bankruptcy protection in this country actually can't afford it. Oftentimes denying relief to the poorest of the poor, and those able to secure relief are those with good incomes and good lawyers. It's interesting how many times the harshest rebukes in the Old Testament are when the nation would deny the poor justice. Now, one of the things that we do in this country is we have court-appointed defenders. And you know, if you've ever had to be protected by one, that is not a good deal. They're overworked, underpaid, and most everybody, when they find out they have a court-appointed defender and they can't afford a real lawyer, just give in and believe that there is no justice for them, typically. I can tell you that in my own experience in life, that those who were depending on the court-appointed system were usually found guilty regardless. Specifically, over and over again throughout the Old Testament, those who deny the poor justice, he says to them that he accuses them not of just denying the poor justice, but specifically the idea of them selling court decisions because the only persons who find justice are those who can afford the best lawyers. Did you know that? That's in the Old Testament. That's not something, that's not a new phenomenon that we've suddenly uncovered recently. That's right there in the Old Testament. Now, if you've never been poor, chances are you find these statements hard to believe. I grew up on the other side of things. I grew up at fairly well off. My dad was an oil executive, and I didn't know, my dad even grew up in the Depression, and he told me many a times that the only thing he knew about the Depression was that he could get a butterscotch milkshake for a nickel every day. In other words, my dad never experienced the Depression. My mother did, but my dad didn't. He had no idea what the Depression was. He read about it in books. He didn't experience that. His dad had a good job the whole time. They were never without. They never experienced those things. And so I grew up in a home where there was plenty. I always had the things that I wanted. And I remember, that the first time that I really got myself in some big trouble, and we were going to court, and my dad said, "Look, this is, you just follow my lead and everything will be fine." Okay. So I was worried I was going to lose my license. And let me tell you, that's what should have really happened. Okay. Just being honest. But that day, my dad, he took me in for a haircut, cut my hair short, because I definitely did not wear my hair short by any stretch of the imagination. And he put me in a nice suit, put on a brand new suit on me. And we went into that courtroom and he had me park my car right out front in the 1 hour parking. He said, "This will not take long." Man, I was feeling good. He goes, just shut up and follow my lead. Yes, sir. I walked in the courtroom, and just before me, a young man got up. His hair long and greasy. His clothes kind of soiled. No daddy there to represent him. And I remember that no matter what he said, that how that judge just came after him and berated him. And finally, in desperation, he said something kind of foolish. And man, they threw the book at him. And I was scared at that moment. And my dad said, taps me on the leg, and he goes, "Follow my lead. Watch this." And we walked up, and the best way that my daddy had taught me all my growing up, I had all my manners in place, and my daddy did all the talking. And in a few moments, I walked out scot-free and got in my car and drove away. But I never forgot that kid. I never forgot that kid whose daddy wasn't there. I never forgot that kid who didn't know to put on a brand new suit and look the part. Who didn't know things about his manners, who wasn't brought up that way. And I knew I was guilty. And then I became an adult. After growing up and all of that, and I fell in love with this thing called church planting, and I also discovered poverty in the process. But here's the thing, is I was shocked to find out how differently I was treated as a broke adult over how I was treated as a young man growing up in the home of an oil executive. The school I went to is where George Bush's kids also went to school. And I will add to that, I was even more shocked to find out how differently not only my friends who lacked financial means were treated in courts of law, but also my friends who were in that moment of the wrong skin color. I've been told plenty of times that that doesn't happen in this land, but I got to tell you, I've seen it firsthand many a time. Probably the most recent situation that has gripped my heart terribly was riding with one of my professors. He had two PhDs, The other man that was in the front seat also had his doctorate degree. They both lived in nice neighborhoods in the Chicago area. We were driving in a brand new Cadillac CTS. They were wearing suits and ties. Everybody looked nice in the car. And we were driving through a neighborhood, and we got stopped. And I watched as they treated those men like boys with contempt. And I remember that things only got worse the moment I thought to myself, I don't get treated like this at a stop. And I said something. Oh, how dare I question whether this was just. And so I'm reminded that those issues of justice are very real in the world. That people do get treated differently. You know, typically whenever it comes to things like this, these issues of justice, there are things that we in the evangelical church don't really like to talk about. We usually leave that to the liberal churches to talk about justice, and we talk about salvation because that's the good and that's the fun stuff. We talk about people getting saved and forgiven of their sins, and we just kind of forget this other part. But here's the thing is that as I go through the Old Testament, I make my way into the New Testament, I find that fully half of everything that's said there talks about these issues of justice, about how we deal with the land. And I'm reminded of the fact that when they were coming into the land and he was telling them about what was important for them to do, how to treat people in the land that they were going into, how to treat one another, that on the top of his list was this issue of poverty and justice, of mercy for those who could not speak up for themselves, who didn't have the voice or the ability or the power to do so. And his constant warning to them that if they ignored these issues, that he would ignore the pleas of their cries when they were in difficult times. That he says that he would protect them. They said, you won't even borrow from other nations. And you will not experience, and I will defend you. Have you thought about the simple fact that there was a time when we were a nation that didn't borrow, nor never had anything happen on our land? Isn't it classic how we can plead for mercy for ourselves and then seem to hate it when God shows mercy to other people? I think maybe it's because at the heart of it, we don't understand that relationship of forgiveness and our relationship with the Lord. So he says to us, don't begrudge your brother who's in need. And furthermore, do not begrudge your poor brother because you know that the 7 years are about to come and provide him some relief. In other words, don't say to yourself, well, soon he's going to get something anyhow, so why should I do anything? Why should it bother me? Why should it upset my life? Why should it change anything for me? And in that moment, the rebuke comes and he says, no, even when you know they're about to get help from someplace else, he asked you for the help. Do not think that you will be innocent. And if he cries out against you, I will hear his cry. And I will hold it as sin against you. See, I know that there are things such as discernment. I agree with the idea of discernment, but there's this danger when we use discernment for an excuse to not do anything. See, I know this. I know that there is no way that I can write enough checks to solve all the problems in Hernando County. I know that. I know that everybody has to live on what they have, on their budget. I can't then just give everything away and then. But on the other hand, if the help that I think I can afford in a month is less than, hear me out here, if the help that I can afford to give my brother in a month is less than I spend in an average week on my own personal lunch, I think it's time to reevaluate whether or not we're really committed to justice and mercy. And what does it mean to be committed to justice and mercy? or to care about the poor. What does that really mean? I mean, does it mean when I pull out my wallet in that moment and I look and I've got a 50 and a 10 that I give the 10? Is that committed to mercy? Is it committed to mercy whenever I scrounge my pockets for my change, or is it committed to mercy whenever moments like these happen and we put pictures up on the wall and I write a check in a moment of tenderness of heart or whatever? What does it mean for you and I? What does it mean for me to be merciful to the poor, to care about my brother, to give to him who asks of me, and not to pass it off on the government or the church leaders or me, my walk with God? And here's the deal. And worse yet, that I would feel disgruntled over what someone else is forgiven. Now, I will say this. I'm not referring to the kind of, you know, like back in 2008 when the corporation fat cats got off the way they did, because that really was taking from the poor and giving to the rich. I get that. I had problems with that too. But what about when those who are poor get better than rice and beans? Does it ever make you mad when someone who's getting assistance eats well? I mean, God provides for you, doesn't he? Many times, well beyond what you, what's that word? Oh yeah, deserve. What do you deserve? What do you deserve? And we find ourselves becoming jealous of other people's blessings, jealous of the poor. And I think if we really understood our own sin debt, if we understand what we owed and how God forgave us and gave us abundantly above all that we could think or ask for. See, here's the thing that I find myself doing more and more today, and I think it's important for us all to do, is that to consider our interaction with the poor and think about what it means in terms of our relationship with God. And, you know, what's intriguing to me is that as we go through these texts, and there are multiples of them, that it's just woven all through the Scripture. It's just, it's undeniable there, is that as we're looking at these issues of justice and of poverty and things like that, that almost always it segues into these issues of slavery. Guess why? Follow the money. Follow the money. See, slavery, even sexual slavery, is first and foremost about money and power. And the issues of slavery and money are always tied together in the Old Testament over and over again. The rebuke that comes to nations over and over again, and the fallout of when a nation ignores its poor, it's always quite devastating what happens to a nation when it forgets its poor. Now, here's the deal. There is no earthly economic system that's without problems. There's just not. I mean, first of all, fallen human beings are involved, aren't they? And so if there's fallen human beings and there's money, there's bound to be a problem. It's just the way it works. But what God warns Israel about over and over a time, is their disregard for the poor. Not even, I'm talking about even just the idea of food and homes and things like that. But even the specifically this issue of justice for those who are shut out of the system. Do you know, when you look at through the history of Israel, here's the thing that's always intriguing. Every time you see Israel fall, we always love to point to the whole issues about their sin in terms of their moral depravity and things like that. We'll also point to their idolatry. Those are the things that we feel comfortable talking about in the evangelical church. But every time that you look through those issues where Israel was overcome, one of the biggest charges against them, fully a third of the charges against them over and over again, is this issue of that not giving justice to the poor. And specifically, it talks about that when they go into court, and they are treated differently than those who can afford protection. And so over and over again, this issue comes up of that how they treat their poor, and the reason that God brought other nations in to judge them, the reason he lifted his hands of blessing off of them, was not only because of their idolatry, and not only because of their immoral behavior, but because of their failure to provide justice for their poor. Now, I got to say this about our country. We're better than many countries for helping our poor. It's not perfect, but I think we do try to do more than any place I've ever been. I've lived in other countries and all, and I can say a lot of good things about what we do. But even as I say that, can I just say this to you, and please don't try to pigeonhole me in your political affiliation by this, because I think both parties are a mess. I'm over them both. I'll just be real honest. But isn't it funny that when there are times of moral crisis in this land, we cry out, oh no, you can't do that. This is a Christian nation. That you can't do that. This is a Christian nation. But the moment it comes to issues of poverty, that's when we start to backpedal and we go, oh no, this is a secular state and the church has to do that. Hello? Where are the people crying it's a Christian nation then? See, and when that happens, and when people say, well, the churches are supposed to handle all of that, I always wonder, is that person actually giving a full tithe to their church when they say that? I think it's a real question of the heart. It's kind of like saying, the poor you will always have with you, and then doing nothing about it because, well, Jesus said they'll always be with you. And God the Father said it too. And he said, and then you will do these things about it. I know when I say stuff like that, I lose a lot of people emotionally because, see, there's the thing is that now I'm actually kind of getting down into the place where we live. And one of those big places that we live is in our political affiliations and how we think about what things should happen in the world and how those political philosophies typically trump our actual belief system. But can I plead with you this? That is, Israel was about to inherit a land flowing with milk and honey, a land like yours and mine, that God spent a whole week with them just dealing with the issues of justice for the poor. And that repeatedly, when they were pulled out of the land and sent away, that this was fully a third of their problems continually. And then the last thing I want to address is just what God says about the foreigner. Let me summarize by saying that this, all the laws about aliens in Israel are, you know, were somewhat different for those who were citizens versus those who weren't citizens. And he even says that you can charge them differently. You can have the different laws for them. He never said that was wrong. It is normal in a land to have laws that favor their citizens, to give them certain protections. But also the requirement that God said is that always whenever you, even when you have those different laws, that they should not be without justice in your land. Let it never be that the citizens of other countries, those aliens and strangers, would be treated as less in terms of their value in the eyes of the law, that they would be treated as our guests and not as our enemies. God never allowed for Israel to mistreat their foreign guest. And he said the reason was is because they themselves were all once foreigners themselves. Does that sound anywhat similar to you in the land in which we live in now? Where they settled a land and took it from a people and he said to them to assume that God was watching them to see how they would deal justly with the aliens and the strangers in the land. Now, you know, whenever when we were adopting my daughter Emma from Mexico, you know, one of the things that I got to experience was our immigration process. It was interesting as an American to go through the immigration process with my daughter, Emma. It was very eye-opening. You know, one of the things I have to give the Mexican officials credit for was that, you know, I had always heard that in Mexico, everybody, you know, will do everything they can to, you know, get a bribe from you. And do you know that I was not once asked by a Mexican government official for a bribe? But I can tell you that during her adoption, that I was several times asked for a bribe, just not by a Mexican official. Hello? I don't care where you stand politically on the issue of the whole, you know, there's lots of things to be debated about how we handle the whole thing of the foreign alien coming to this land and how much we can actually absorb and how much we can't absorb and things like that. But can I just tell you that the process really is very broken? When we took my daughter to the doctor in Mexico, but we also had a little pass because we were U.S. citizens and we could take her to the doctor in the U.S., and the visit in the U.S. where my daughter got her shots versus the, what I would have had to pay for that only one approved doctor in all of Mexico at that consulate, the only doctor, a Mexican citizen, who was allowed to give shots so they could be certified by our government so they could get that the a day's worth of shots, those shots that she had to get that we paid just a small less than $100 for in the U.S., that it would have taken well over a month worth of anybody's salary, of anybody in our church in Mexico. And in that moment, I thought to myself, I wonder why the people in my church are sneaking into this country because they say they can't afford, because that's for one person, that's for one child. I couldn't afford those prices. I was an American citizen. I had to go back to the United States so I could afford the doctor in the U.S. at U.S. prices because I couldn't afford the consulate doctor. I had an advantage that day. I can just tell you that no matter what we decide about how, what our laws are with regard to foreigners, what we do with the people who are wanting or coming to this land in the same way that our forefathers came to this land, that it must be just. Lest God see our injustice and lift his hand of protection and blessing off of us as a nation because we don't care about the alien and the stranger. Lest we forget where we came from. And so as we look at these issues, whether we're talking about the poverty issue or we're talking about the issues of race or whether we're talking about the foreigner and the alien and the stranger in the land, the thing that comes down is striking over and over again is that God cries out and he points out those who are in that are powerless, those who do not have authority, those who do not have a legal standing. And he says about all those people, he says to his people, to the people of God, that our relationship with him is evaluated very much in the way that we treat those who are powerless. Whether that powerlessness is by race or money or as a foreign citizen in our land. And we can blame this on politics. But church, at the end of the day, remember it's called We the People. And we are accountable for the way that we vote and act. And when we blame it all on the politicians, when we blame it on the religious leaders, but we don't own up ourselves. It says that judgment, 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 17, judgment begins with the household of faith. See, there's no way that you and I get a pass and we blame the politicians and we blame religious leaders of the 501c3 corporation and say that they're not doing enough when if we aren't doing it. If we don't care about those who aren't getting justice. If we don't care about that alien and the stranger. If we don't care about the poor. It says more about our relationship with God than it does anyone else's. Let's not blame the politicians. Let's not blame the church organization. But let's seek to love mercy, to do justice, and to walk humbly with our God. Let's stand together. We're called to choose. You see, this really is an issue of righteousness. Justice for the poor is really about justice as a whole. And the reality is that when you and I deny the poor justice, when we deny those who are powerless justice, here's the thing is that today it may be all right with you. But tomorrow they may be coming for you. And who will speak up for you when you are the powerless? Who will speak up for you when you are the person without the means? You see, it really is a call on us of righteousness, to choose what is good and right, not because it fits our political philosophies, not because it fits our associations or our standing in the community or anything else, but simply because it is right and it is just. These are not government issues. So just in the way that a nation is judged by its leaders, it is also judged by the acts of its people. Do we love justice? Do we give mercy? Do we walk humbly with our God? I can tell you that I'm excited what we're doing as a church and reaching out into our community and things like that. But the thing that I have to keep asking myself in all of this is to remember that when the church is doing it, it doesn't mean that I'm necessarily doing it. That the call is upon my life and upon my heart to love that justice and mercy. To want to do right by those who do not have no voice, have no means, lack justice in my land. Not only for the alien and the stranger, but even, what about my brother whose skin is a different shade than mine? And when we try to make light of that or dismiss it or explain it away or even try to gauge it based on actions of things and when we only have part of the story, can I just tell you that it just rings hollow? They're empty words to not care. What if it was your child? What if it's your loved one? What if someday it's you? Because no one spoke out. Because nobody said it wasn't just. Because nobody said that your way of life was just as much in need of protection as everyone else's way of life in the land. I hear lots of talk about worried about us as Christians getting mistreated someday. And who will cry out for you? So here we are, a people who've been called by God to live lives that are righteous, live lives that are in step with the hands of and the feet of Jesus, that who would do without even for the sake of others. And the call upon our lives is to live that kind of life. not out of our affluence, but out of our mercy. So I pray as you go through this week, I pray that for you, that God would open your eyes to see all the invisible persons that you cross in your daily life, that you would see them with your Father's eyes, that you would see the invisible, the people that who are on the margins of society, the people who are left out or who've been discounted and counted out. You know, I know that we have one of the homeless guys in our community who actually owns a house. And he doesn't stay in it. His life is so broken. He is so broken after the Vietnam War. He lives out on the street with his friends. I know people make choices that I can't explain and I can't fix. But I know that I can deal with them justly. I know that I can love them. I can be merciful to them. On a cold day, I could give him a ride to his house. Or feed him. I pray for you and I that God would open our eyes to see the invisible persons that are in our daily lives and to see them with the Father's eyes. That's my hope and my prayer for you this week. We have prayer team members here that are available to pray with you, to talk with you about anything in your life. It doesn't have to be about the topic of today. It could be about what it means to follow Jesus. It could be that you want to talk about some of the things we did talk about today. It could be that you need physical healing, a touch in your life, or hope, or help. And I would invite you to come for any number of reasons. But my prayer is for you as you go this week, for you to go and to see the world with your Father's eyes. God bless you.